This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that we take one of those issues you feel you need to know about, bring together some of the top minds on the subject, and take 28 minutes to get briefed up on it. You can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds, and it would be really helpful if you tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. And thanks to those of you who have left reviews lately, especially Billy Bob Billy Bob Billy, Scraggy Goat and RPL Box. People with actual names are also welcome. Our question today, is it time for the school examination system in England, Wales and Northern Ireland to be completely overhauled? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Earlier this week, the Conservative chairman of the Education Select Committee said that the GCSE exam, for which more than a million children in England, Wales and Northern Ireland are presently studying, should be abolished because they have become, his word, pointless. The leader of the Head Teachers Union agreed, saying that the exams belonged to a different era. It's an idea which is raised periodically, but has been gaining more support recently. So this week we're asking, should GCSEs be scrapped? Step inside the briefing room to find out. First, in our quest for understanding, how did we end up with the GCSE system, and who decided that 16 was the right age to test skills and knowledge? We asked Serena Tarling to provide us with a crash course in the history of British exams.
Initially in the UK, the public examinations were developed at the end of the 19th century by universities, which were trying to develop a sort of standardised entrance exam.
Peter Mandler is a cultural historian at Cambridge University, where he's traced the evolution of Britain's exam system, starting in the 19th century.
So it was initially for ages 16 to 18, because entry to university in those days wasn't as clearly fixed at 18 as it is today.
So what was it like taking an exam in the 19th century?
They mostly tested pretty factual information. I mean, things like give a short biography of the Duke of Marlborough or explain what the Corn Laws were, why were they repealed? Very short questions, factual information, just seeing what's in kids' heads.
At that point, with most children leaving school at 12 or 13, exams were really just a way of filtering out the most academically capable children who were suited to university. But that soon changed.
So the universities ganged together basically before the First World War and came up with a standard exam, which they called school certificate, and higher school certificate, two exams.
The school certificate was taken at 16. Unlike its predecessors, it was a package of exams in several different subjects, including science, maths, English, or history. The higher school certificate tested children on a much narrower range of subjects. At this stage, most people did not get a full secondary education.
Now, with regard to secondary education.
But more change was coming.
What are we suggesting there? We are suggesting secondary education for all, and that shall be free.
The Butler Act in 1944 widened access to secondary schools and brought more children into the exam system.
After the Second World War, you now have universal secondary education. A minority are going to go to a grammar school, and they'll be taking exams, and they'll be staying maybe to 16. The majority are going to secondary modern schools mostly, and they'll be leaving school at 15, still generally without taking any exams. But for the minority, the school certificate and the higher school certificate is replaced by O and A levels. And O and A levels are pretty much the same as the school certificate and the higher school certificate. They're taken at 16 and 18. The main difference is that it's no longer a package of exams. You don't have to pass a range of subjects. You can have 2 O levels, you can have 5 O levels. But otherwise, the system is very much as it had been before, and it's still only available to a minority of all teenagers.
How old are you?
13. 13 in June.
When are you going to leave school?
Well, I'm 15. I'd like to be an engineer. I did start off wanting to be a carpenter, but I've grown out of that, and I'd like to be an engineer, putting telephones in and all that.
When you get comprehensive education coming in the 60s, starting already in the late 50s, the proportion of students taking O-levels starts to rise. Strangely, just at this moment, for reasons having to do with the politicians rather than the demand from below, in 1965, they introduce a new exam for those students who can't or don't take O-levels, that is, the less academic students, and this is the CSE. And the CSE is, again, meant to be a more flexible exam which offers a wider range of subjects, but it's clearly seen as a second-tier exam. It doesn't offer access to A-levels, it doesn't offer access to higher education, but it does point towards a loosening of the exam structure, which is gradually going to spread in the 70s and 80s.
But loosening the exam system was not enough for some reformers.
When Margaret Thatcher appointed me as Secretary of State for Education, I thought I was going to get a list from her of things she wanted, not at all.
She may not have had a to-do list, but Kenneth Baker understood that, as in all things, the Prime Minister wanted to see decisive action.
She said to me, "Will you go away and think what you think should be done to the education system and come back to me in 4 weeks' time?" There was a proposal from my predecessor, Keith Joseph, to combine two exams. One was a very low-grade CSE exam, which was virtually not worth taking, to a GCSE, as it were. So there'd be one exam at 16.
Kenneth Baker picked up Keith Joseph's idea and ran with it. Like Joseph, he felt 16 was the right age to assess students.
When I took the old school certificate in 1950, 93% of students left school, so they had to have a certificate saying what they'd achieved. By 1980s, it was lower than 93%, but it was still very high in the 40s and 50s. And so there was a need to record what a child had achieved.
Kenneth Baker's GCSE plan was part of a radical overhaul of the whole education system. He introduced a national curriculum and shifted financial control away from local authorities to head teachers. It was not without opposition.
When you're engaged in fundamental reform, as I was, you must have the support of the Prime Minister, and she supported me very loyally, though we had very strong differences upon the actual construction of the curriculum. And I remember once when she said, "Look, Kenneth, in 10 minutes I've got to go and meet King Hussein of Jordan and discuss peace in the Middle East. Why are you still being so stubborn in supporting this?" And I knew how to handle her. I jollied her along.
With the backing of Margaret Thatcher, as well as universities and employers, Kenneth Baker was able to push through his reforms.
The purpose of the GCSE was to establish high standards for all students at 16, but also a grade so that everybody could get some, would find a footing somewhere on the grade on each subject. And that was really very important, because you don't want to discourage children by failing them. An exam is to identify the ability of a child, and if it's not very great, then you must give extra help and extra teaching. And that was successfully achieved.
But once the school leaving age was raised to 18, the great champion of GCSEs changed his mind.
I think GCSEs will eventually fade out, because you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose? If you're training someone from 4 to 18, or examining at 16, what you ought to do at 14 is to assess the interest of the child as to what course they want to follow. Do they want to follow academic, or do they want to follow technical, or sporting, whatever it may be? And then the curriculums of the school should be modified to accept those streams. And I think that will actually happen, because British industry is going to make it happen.
Lord Baker ending that crammer from Serena Tarling, which also featured Peter Mandler. So what are the alternatives to the GCSE system? To find out how and when other countries test students, I'm joined by Sandra Leighton-Gray, Associate Professor at the Institute of Education at University College London. Sandra Leighton-Gray, can we just get straight first? Does everywhere in the UK have GCSEs?
No. Each region has a slightly different system. So the English and Welsh systems are pretty comparable. But in Northern Ireland, they tend to have a different model. And in Scotland, you've got something called National Five that people sit around the age of 15, 16, slightly more flexible in timing terms than GCSEs.
How do GCSEs in England and Wales and Northern Ireland differ from exams set at 16 in most other European Union countries?
Most countries don't really have big bang exams at the age of 16. There is normally a lot more teachers' continuous assessment of pupils, and sometimes they have a couple of exams in key subject areas, but it's quite rare to have a big spread and for the country to have a complete collective nervous breakdown over the whole examination process.
So, say, in France or Germany or any of the large European countries, what do they do at 16?
So, in France, a lot of kids will sit something called the brevet, where you've got continuous assessment, and then they've got one oral and three written exams.
And what age would that be?
So about 15, 16, something like that. Germany, it's really quite different because they triage students.
Triage, they sort them out.
Yeah, they sort them out into different categories at the age of 11, a bit like our 11 plus did, but without an 11 plus. And the kids that go to the kind of equivalent to the secondary modern school, or that's a very, very loose term, they will perhaps sit something called Mittlere Reife at about the age of 15, 16. And some of those kids will transfer to Gymnasien, which is the university track school.
So the Mittlere Reife, what kind of exam is that?
So you'll sit something like 8 subjects, maybe 10 subjects, and you'll get individual marks for each of those subjects on a certificate at the end.
Do other countries publish league tables like we do in much of the UK?
Absolutely not. And in fact, in places like Germany, the information is secret. So you don't know how...
Secret?
Pretty much secret. So you don't know how schools compare within a local area. Now, somebody in local government will have a big folder with all the information in, and behind the scenes, there's things at work. But there's just no right to know how these different schools did in different respects.
So how do parents know what's a good school and what's not from the point of view of getting exam results?
The same way we all did before 1988, in that we sort of go in and sniff the air, really, and talk to other parents and go by reputation and that kind of thing. But there is no league table system.
GCSEs help direct students to doing either further, higher or vocational education. You've explained how that might happen in Germany. What about other countries?
When students sit tests at about the age of 15 or 16, they're looking at whether to feed somebody down a university track route or not. So, for example, in Italy, from the age of 14 to 19, they'll sit an exam every year. But in Italy, everybody's entitled to start university, so you don't get filtered out in the same way. In Poland, you have continuous assessment and just 3 basic exams.
And these are internal exams?
They tend to be either teacher-moderated assessment, or sometimes they're set regionally, occasionally set nationally in smaller countries. So there's some consistency of standards.
So is there anywhere else that does what we do, which is have to have a kind of great big bang at 16?
Malta and Ireland.
What, in general, would Europeans think about our system of GCSEs and external examinations and their use as ranking points?
They don't really see the point, because it's not the terminal endpoint of education for most young people anymore, so that you're really looking at the age of about 18.
And what do they think about the kind of all or nothingness of our GCSE?
They think that's quite stressful. and also the lack of flexibility of age. So in other countries, there's more flexibility about what school year you can be in. So in the UK now, it's really unusual to be in a school year with people that are younger or older than you.
Sandra Leighton-Gray. So how do the results of our system compare with those around the world? Few people have thought about this more than Andreas Schleicher. He's Director for Education and Skills at the OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development. He joined me from Paris. Andreas Schleicher, what do you make of our GCSE system?
I do believe that exams as such and high-stakes exams have a very important function in education. You know, they set quite powerful signals to students what is important. They tell parents, they give teachers guidance.
Some people would say that the GCSE system essentially is a kind of legacy of fitting people for universities. In other words, it's a ladder system which takes you then to A-levels and then takes you to university. And that's, in a sense, its limitation.
Yeah, and you know, and to some extent, I would agree with that. I do think the school system in the UK has traditionally been geared towards entry into universities and left a lot of people for whom that was not the kind of ideal place of learning, be sort of behind and out of place. In a way, you know, you can ask yourself what GCSEs tell you about education today, but you can also ask yourself the question, what should students learn today and be examined on in order to be successful for tomorrow? Now, it's always much easier to educate people for our past than for their future. And I think that's a very important question that exams should ask themselves too.
Can we go into that a little bit? What do you mean by we educate them for our past rather than their futures?
Well, I mean, that's obviously easy. And education are always inherently conservative social systems, you know, and as parents, we are often a part of the problem. We get often very anxious when our children learn things that we did not learn when we were young, or we get even angry when they no longer learn things that we felt were so terribly important for our lives. You know, ask yourself why in England you put so much emphasis on trigonometry. You ask to people at the workplace, you know, is trigonometry really a very central part of, you know, knowledge these days? And they'll tell you, trigonometry? No, that's basically done by computers these days. The reason why that is in your curriculum and in your exams is simply that this was something that was very, very important, you know, 300-400 years ago, and people needed those tools to measure the size of the fields. And we have kept those things moving along because it's always very difficult to take anything out of the education system.
Andreas, let's imagine you have three children aged between 11 and 16. What kind of exam system would you, as an educationist, ideally like to see them having to go through?
Yeah, I know. And an exam which includes work with teachers, perhaps an interviewing situation, an exam where they can explore ideas, where they can produce complex essays, and exams which test their capacity to think critically, maybe to work collaboratively. You know, in a way, today, when you test mathematics, success is no longer just about, you know, knowing equations, formulas. The key is, can you think like a mathematician? The same in history. You know, history is not about names and places and people. It's about your capacity to understand how the narrative of a society has emerged, how it's developed, thinking like an historian, thinking like a philosopher. Those are the kind of things that I would like to see students demonstrate in an exam.
Andreas, I'd like, just like to explore a little bit further this question that you raised about why it's so hard to reform education systems. I mean, certainly it seems to me, as somebody who's looked at the British education system for a long time, that it is spectacularly difficult to get even a relatively rational discussion about how the education system should work, let alone to actually change it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And once again, we as consumers, as parents, are often part of that problem. Now, we are very conservative in our thinking. Teachers are more likely to teach how they were taught than how they were taught to teach. I think that's also a big issue because, again, our work organization in school is very industrial. Teachers work in isolation in classrooms. They have very few experiences actually to work laterally. And as a politician, you know, you can lose an election over education, but you rarely win one over education because it just takes so long to translate good ideas into bad outcomes. So it is very hard. There's also a big asymmetry between winners and losers from educational change. People who believe they pay the price are very vocal in this system. So it is very hard to change. But at the very same time, you know, we're talking about the future. Our schools today are going to be our economy, our society tomorrow. And the gap between what our societies demand and what our exam systems test today is not becoming smaller every day. It's becoming wider.
Andreas Schleicher. So what are the options for change? And whatever they are, will any of them actually happen? With me now are Sir Mike Tomlinson, former Chief Inspector for Ofsted, who 14 years ago headed an independent inquiry into A-level standards, and Laura McInerney, former editor of Schools Week, former teacher and a regular writer on education issues. Sir Mike Tomlinson, this all must seem like deja vu to you. You came up with a whole reform package over a decade ago. What did you conclude then?
Well, we concluded that with the changes being made by the then government to raise the education leaving age to 18, 19, and also to give 14-year-olds the choice of going full-time to an FE college,
further education college,
we automatically had a distinct break at 14. And therefore, what we were looking at was, over a period of time, a 14 to 19 period of education. Not necessarily in school, it could be in college, it could be work-based training, apprenticeship or whatever. And so we devised a system which would give the qualifications at 19.
So the GCSEs would go up.
Well, I think what we said at the time, and I would hold to that now, was that they, in their present format, absorb an enormous amount of teaching time. They also cost the school an awful lot, straight out of its budget. And in many cases, the GCSEs did not tell employers what they wanted to know, notably about literacy and numeracy. And therefore, we suggested that they needed reforming to provide a sensible and easily implemented progress check for the 16-year-old in order to inform their choices post-16 and also to make sure that they'd made the progress that was expected up to that stage.
Would there be results which would be published externally and the data collected?
Yes, there would. There would be results at two points at 18, 19. One, each of the subjects that they studied to whatever level would have not a separate certification in their own right, but could have a number associated with them. As, for example, does the International Baccalaureate. And then at the end, you would have a point score, either at what is called level 2, which is GCSE level, or level 3A level.
But not at 16?
But not necessarily at 16, no. Though if the student left school at that point, they could take with them what they'd already got, because one of the things we stressed was that these qualifications should not be age-related. They could leave school and go to employer's premises and complete them. They could go on to an apprenticeship. We don't want this very strict in this country, age-related achievement measure.
OK, well, let's part for the moment what it was that your review said and just go to Laura McInerney. Laura, what do you think of Robert Halfen's notion of scrapping GCSEs?
You know, we have a problem, which is that in this country, for historical reasons, our schools largely run from 11 to 16, our secondary school system. And therefore, there is a change in building at 16 for many young people. And therefore, that's a natural passing out point. And so our post-16 providers need to be able to figure out who they're going to take in. And one way to do that is to use tests that are done at the age of 16, which are the GCSEs. Also, if you choose to leave at 16 and go and do a job, you need to have something to take with you. And those 11 to 16 institutions need some way of being performance managed by politicians. And that's what so far GCSEs do. When people try and come up with an alternative, what they usually do is create some type of other test that isn't as rigorous as GCSEs and usually fails on at least one of those three things.
Now, there's an interesting building determinism in part of your answer, which it says, well, the one major reason why you might not want to do whatever the alternative is because we just don't have the buildings for it. Is that a really gigantic factor?
I think that it is. When you look back at what happened after the Tomlinson review, and actually all across the country, teachers like myself who were in the classroom at the time were trying desperately to make 14 to 18 work. But to do that, you had to be able to allow 14-year-olds to go to FE college some of the week or have children in your school for the diplomas. And it was chaotic. We couldn't, in the end, make it work. If you lived in a rural area, you may not have had all of that provision available to you anyway. Those of us who were in cities had kind of children pinging off left, right and centre, and we just just couldn't manage the behaviour, the records and everything else. So when we try and make 14 to 18 happen as a phase in schools, there's just some logistical problems that make it very difficult.
Well, let me ask you this question. Suppose we had no building difficulties. That wasn't an issue for us at all. We were starting with a clean slate. Would you start with a system that included a public examination at 16?
I don't think it matters if it's public or not. I mean, an alternative is the International Baccalaureate, which is actually very successful and not dissimilar to the baccalaureate that the Tomlinson Review suggested and has lots of different subjects, lots of different skills. But there are still examinations at 16 and again at 18. So for me, if we were going to just get rid of the whole thing, yeah, let's take the International Baccalaureate like many other countries do. It's a good currency. It's global. It's well worked out. And don't spend years trying to come up with a new type of qualification, which may or may not be any good.
Now, one of the things that we've heard is that it actually costs schools quite a lot to do external examinations, and they might be better off doing internal examinations. And from what I can tell from what Mike Tomlinson was saying, quite a lot of what would be being done under the terms of his review would actually be internal school assessment. What do you feel about that?
I'm actually proud that as a country, we spend a lot of money to make sure that the exam system at 16 is very rigorous, very objective and very fair. When you look at teacher assessment, we know that there are all kinds of cultural biases that creep in. It's very difficult when you spend all day with children not to sort of take into account things that perhaps you shouldn't be taking into account. And so, you know, you'll find that actually often assessment that's done by a teacher can be more racist, can be more sexist. And I think it's great that we spend this money making sure that the GCSEs are super rigorous, fair and objective.
OK, Mike, what do you make of those as arguments?
It isn't a case of only internal assessment. You can easily have a system which gives you some external parameters. Exam boards do it now. You only have to look at City and Guilds and they do it.
Well, what about Laura's argument that part of the problem we've had, or we could conceivably have with internal assessment, is hidden bias?
I think you can overcome it. I mean, I'm not arguing that it doesn't exist at all. What I am arguing is that that can be overcome by having a bank of tests externally available and use those, as indeed does Norway for its assessments, use it to actually validate the school's assessment. Going way, way back, we did it when French O-level as such as that time had an element which was spoken French where you sat in front of someone.
I know, I did it.
I did it too. So the idea that what I'm proposing is new is just not true.
What about Laura's point about the intractability of our building stock?
No, I think that is a valid point, as is Laura's point about rural settings as well. I do accept we would have difficulties in some areas, but at the end of the day, what we should be focusing on are not the difficulties, but actually, more importantly, having decided what is in the best interests of the nation and our children, then how do we overcome those obstacles?
One of the things that Andrea Schleicher said is that the problem is that you can lose an election because of education, but you can't win one because the timescales are too big, and that the forces of conservatism are just going to be too big for you to undertake major change. And in a way, that's exactly what happened to you, isn't it?
To a degree, yes, and Andreas is absolutely right, as usual. You will not necessarily win votes by appearing to threaten something which one part of the population thinks is sacrosanct. Our GCSE and our A-level were designed way back for a very specific purpose. They're now used for very different purposes. I would argue it doesn't add up anymore.
Laura McNerney, one very important question here, obviously, is what politicians think that they can sell to parents. The other major issue is whether teachers are up for significant reform. What do you think?
So I don't think teachers are up for significant reform. Ultimately, the GCSEs do get re-specified every few years. So there have been and always will be every few years a going over of them. So teachers constantly have to deal with change. I think what they get annoyed with is when revolution is promised, everything is thrown up in the air and then it comes clattering back down. So there's no reason why we can't tweak the GCSE system. You know, there are some things that have happened in the last few years which haven't been great. I think the loss of some applied or more vocational vocational GCSEs when Michael Gove became Education Secretary because he didn't like them was tantamount to vandalism. That's okay. Instead of scrapping GCSEs, we could just bring back the vocational ones. If we don't like the particular mix that children are doing of GCSEs, we could play around with that. But I think that revolution, when it all falls apart because a new party gets in or a politician doesn't like it, that's when teachers get really upset.
So Mike Thompson, do you actually think that any significant change is likely to happen?
All I can say is over the last 12, 18 months, I've had more people and bodies either contacting me or speaking to me directly to say it's about time we implemented the report. It would certainly, I think, indicate that there is still some hunger around for more radical change than we've got.
So Mike Tomlinson there and Laura McInerney. And if I had to sum that up, I'd say that though there is quite a lot of pressure for change and quite a lot of good reason why change should happen, it's practically extremely difficult and politically probably impossible. My thanks also to Serena Tarling, Andrea Schleicher, Kenneth Baker, Peter Mandler and Sandra Leighton-Gray. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Helen Grady, Serena Tarling and Kirstine Knight. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. We've got an episode, for instance, on grammar schools. You might like to listen to that.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.